from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 2011, Yale law professor Amy Chua published Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, claiming that strict Chinese-style parenting is better than the more relaxed American style. That raised a storm. Now she's back with more controversy and a new book written with her husband Jed Rubenfeld called The Triple Package. They say certain groups are succeeding in America, Jews, Chinese, Mormons, Cubans, because their culture gives them a sense of superiority, a sense of insecurity, and a lot of impulse control. That formulation is drawing a charge of racism. The authors say the whole country could use it. This hour on Point, we're talking culture and success in America with Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Why do you think some cultural groups are doing better than others in the USA? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll hear pushback in a bit from a sociologist who strongly disagrees with Chua and Rubenfeld's thesis. But right now, joining me from New York are Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld, co-authors of The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. They are husband and wife, professors both of law at Yale Law School. Amy Chua wrote Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. Jed Rubenfeld writes thrillers and books on constitutional law. Amy Chua, Jed Rubenfeld, welcome to On Point. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us on your show, Tom.
It's good to have you. I have to tell you, it was a little bit of a close thing. Every day when the show's over, we sit down and we plan our, you know, shows ahead. And I don't know if I have ever heard a hotter debate at our conference room table than about whether or not to have you guys on to talk about this. Now I've read it, I've seen it, I've got it, but man, you know how to put the stick right on the beehive, Amy. What is it about your approach to writing that gets people so riled up?
Honestly, my first book was a memoir. It was supposed to be tongue-in-cheek, and I thought, okay, this time I am not going near parenting. And, I mean, you have seen the book. You see that it's a book that's really supported by research and empirical findings. So I think whenever you talk about groups and cultures, people respond often without even having read the book. I think the book should be thought-provoking. I think there are fascinating case studies and actual studies in there, but I'm perplexed by the kind of explosive reaction.
Jed, you're a brave man. You saw the tiger mom reaction that your good wife brought out, and yet you walked right in here with her. Why do you think people are up in arms? Not everybody, but plenty of people. And, I mean, online, when we said we're going to talk to Amy Chua and you, Jed, and people saying no with about 100 O's after it. What is it about the approach or perspective that brings that out?
Well, look, anytime you talk about groups in America, there's going to be sensitivity. But our book is the polar opposite of racist. I really want to stress this. We show that there are African-American groups and Hispanic-American groups outperforming the national average, outperforming the white average. Our whole book is written to prove that the factors propelling success have nothing to do with race, nothing to do with skin color. You know, here's the thing as I see it. It's a tough economy. Inequality is rising, and yet the striking fact is that all across America, in some groups, and there aren't just eight, there are dozens of groups, but in some groups, much more than others, much more than the rest of America, people are still rising. People are still succeeding. And what we're saying is, can't we look at that? Let's look at those groups. Are we too afraid to look at that? If we're too afraid to look at that and see what they're doing, how are we ever going to learn anything?
I take your point, and yet, Amy, the first time you and I talked was more than 10 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
And what was the book was World on
World
Fire.
World on Fire, I think, yeah.
That was a book about how, terrible passions, violence, and all the rest that the success of some groups can inspire in others. I mean, you harkened back, as I recall in that book, to your own Chinese, was it grandmother in the Philippines who had her throat slit by her chauffeur?
Yes.
I mean, so you're alert to these dangers. You know what's happened over the years in Malaysia and Indonesia, where the Bumiputra, the sort of local Malays, came out and slaughtered Chinese. Jed, you know what happened in Europe with Jews. There's no secret in that. Is it dangerous to talk about this stuff this way, Amy?
Tom, you know, I never think it's a healthy strategy to bury facts. I mean, I just think that that can't be right. I think you need to address the underlying dynamics that create this kind of resentment. But to answer your question, look at the title of our book. It's about the rise and fall of cultural groups. That's why these charges of cultural racism are just so perplexing to me. It's not that we're saying that some groups are superior. We're simply saying that, look, we have a snapshot in time. We're looking at the economy right now, really tough economy, and some groups seem to be rising, in many cases from lower class, I mean very poor, modest origins, to much higher status. Now, that doesn't mean they're better. And interestingly, after a few generations, those groups are no longer successful. It's very dynamic, very fluid. The groups that are successful today were not successful 20 years ago, and there will be different groups in the future. So I think a big part of this book that people are just not focusing on is generational decline. This kind of dynamic that happens in any group, that once you start getting more successful, and this could be a family, it could be a nation, it could be an ethnic group. Once you start getting more successful, you lose that, the second leg of our triple package we call insecurity, the feeling like, wait, I might not survive, or I'm an outsider, I need to prove myself. And, you know, so that's the kind of thought-provoking issue that we're trying to raise.
Jed, so you're saying these are cultural traits that come and go? A sense of superiority, sense of insecurity, a sense of sticking with it. Take Jewish culture. Is that a come and go package for Jews?
Can I just mention one of the most fascinating things that we found in our research? You know that Asian American kids are famously doing better than other kids in terms of test scores, grades. They're famously excelling. Now, sociologists went and dug behind the data, and here's what they found. Third generation Asian American kids, no difference in academic performance whatsoever. No difference whatsoever.
Difference from what, now, Jed? From what? From the norm or from their high achieving earlier generation?
No difference between them and other American kids.
Mm-hmm.
And what this does is totally explode the model minority myth. It shows it's not innate. It shows it's not biological. What it shows is that there is something happening in the culture, in the families of the first and second generation that's driving this kind of success. And that's what's so fascinating about it.
But your question about do they fade, I wanted to address, actually, yes. That's what's so not rigid about our theory. You know, you have
chosen people has been around for quite a while.
Well, actually, the insecurity, a lot of Jews are wondering, finally, Jews in America today may be the least insecure that they've been in probably in the history of the people. And a lot of people wonder, mm-hmm. That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
We have a fascinating case about second-generation Holocaust survivors. That's a fascinating case. Lots of research has been done on the unusual stress that this group feels. But it's so interesting to see that it's actually our thesis exemplified. They are an unusually successful group, the children of Holocaust survivors. They feel there's often enormous amounts of impulse control when they were growing up because they don't want to, disturb their parents. They have incredibly high expectations. They feel that they're in a way carrying the weight of the world. They need to succeed for all the people who died. It's a really fascinating case.
And insecurity, by definition, turned to the max there. Amy, give us the formula, the triple package. We've got 3 minutes before the break here. Lay it out for us. What are you saying is this package of cultural traits, I guess, that lead some groups.
Or psychological.
Okay.
Yes. The first is a sense of exceptionality or of being special. And I want to stress, Tom, that there are many different sources from this, not just belonging to a group. The sense of being special can come from an innate talent. It can come
from
a mother.
You're heavily focused on cultures and groups here, though. I mean, you're defining it. You're saying Chinese, Jewish, Mormon, Nigerian, Cuban, Iranian, Persian, Lebanese.
Mormons. Yeah, let me get back to. Yeah. So that it could also come from a parent instilling the sense of specialness. But the second quality is insecurity, which almost seems like the opposite of this feeling of superiority. It's a feeling that, you haven't quite done enough, that you need to do more, that you need to prove yourself. And the third is impulse control. That is, self-discipline, the ability to persevere and resist temptation. And for us, the most fascinating thing is the interplay of the first two. How is it that some people or some groups disproportionately feel simultaneously insecure and superior? And in all these groups that we talk about, the Cuban Americans, you know, Mormon Americans, you see this kind of on the one side, you know, we are an island of morality.
Mormon language.
Or chosen people. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, and yet people view us as outsiders. They say that we're creepy. Or, you know, Nigerian Americans or Ghanaian Americans or Jamaicans, they come, they have PhDs from their country. They come here, they are stop and frisk. They're treated as criminals. And that can create this feeling of, you know, why should they look down on me? That is outrageous. I will show them, you know, and that can produce, not always, but it can produce this drive, the drive of the outsider that has a lot of, you know, almost resentment. And I am going to rise. And you saw this fuel in the Cuban exiles who lost everything. They were confiscated in Cuba. They came here with $5. And it is not true that they just stepped into being doctors. I mean, former doctors had to drive cars. They had to pick fruit. But they had this triple package in spades, and they instilled it in their children. And that's a real, you know, very jarring case of a very astonishing upward mobility.
A sense of superiority or exceptionalism, a sense of insecurity, impulse control. Jed Rubenfeld, half a minute before the break, but you're offering this as a formula for the whole country. You're saying, America, you ought to feel a little insecure right now. Remember your exceptionalism, control impulse, and go.
Well, I do think that the triple package values are traditional American values: hard work, striving, a sense of exceptionality, wanting to prove yourself. Maybe we've lost a little bit of that in the last 20, 30, 40 years, but these are traditional American values.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour with Tiger Mom Amy Chua and husband Jed Rubenfeld, writing now about what they say makes some ethnic and cultural groups successful in America. And once again, it's controversial. Their toughest critics call it the new racism. They say, look, we've got a formula for success here. Their book is The Triple Package: How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Tiger Mom Talk got all kinds of pushback back in the day, 2011. Here was Arianna Huffington on Morning Joe, MSNBC.
I'm completely against it. The most important thing a mom can give her children is that sense of being loved, no matter whether you succeed or fail. The world is constantly going to be judging them. It's that special treasury of love that you can keep drawing from. And the idea that suddenly discipline and incredible expectations is the way to go as a parent is completely the wrong direction.
Amy Chua drawing out Arianna Huffington in 2011. Yesterday on NBC's Today Show, Sukhetu Mehta repeated what he wrote in Time magazine, that the arguments made in the triple package amount to a new racism.
There have always been people attempting to demonstrate that this or that group is better than this or that group for cultural reasons. This is the new form of racism.
New form of racism, they say right there. But we've got metrics in this book, Jed and Amy say. And Amy, I wonder if you could share some of those with us. The metrics of income and achievement that you're pointing to say, look, these groups are setting themselves apart.
Well, Tom, first of all, you know, one charge is that this is the only way we define success. And that's not true at all. You know, of course, success cannot be equated with happiness. But these measures of income and education are one way that we can measure something. And some statistics are, it is true that Indian Americans, their median household income is about twice the national average. I think it's about 90,000. And Iranian Americans, Lebanese Americans, and below that, Chinese Americans, and by the way, dozens of other groups, Greek Americans, you'd be surprised, Scottish Americans, it's, you know, this is a spectrum. It's not just eight groups, but they also have very disproportionately high median incomes. You know, Cuban Americans, they are about 4% of the Hispanic population. In 2002, I think 4 out of the 10 wealthiest Hispanics in the United States were Cuban, and I think all three of our senators today are our Hispanic senators are Cuban. And so, you know, to me, this is not saying that these groups are better in any way. Again, you know, this may not be the case. I'm wagering it won't be in about, you know, 20 years. But I think if we've gotten to the point where you can't just state a statistic about a group without being accused of stereotyping, then we are not going to be able to address some of the toughest problems. We have terrible problems with poverty and education, and to kind of blindly say we can't talk about this entire aspect of, you know, how some people raise their children, what goes on in the household, I think we're tying one arm behind our back.
Here, from the Triple Package, Amy and Jed Wright, what do the current or recent CFOs or CEOs of American Express, Black & Decker, Citigroup, Dell, Fisher-Price, Deloitte, JetBlue, Marriott International, Sears Roebuck, Huntsman, Skull Candy, Sam's Club, Madison Square Garden have in common? They're all members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Mormons. They go on to say Indian Americans have the highest income of any census-tracked ethnic group, almost twice the national average. Chinese, Iranian, and Lebanese Americans, not far behind. Asians are now so overrepresented at Ivy League schools, they write, that they're being called the new Jews, and many believe that tacit quotas are being applied against them. It's important to emphasize, they write, that even the children of poor and poorly educated East Asian immigrants, Chinese seamstresses, Korean grocers, Vietnamese refugees outperform other racial minority groups and their white American counterparts. Meanwhile, the actual Jews continue to rack up Nobel Prizes, they write, Pulitzer Prizes, Tony Awards, and hedge fund billions at a rate wildly disproportionate to their numbers in a nationwide study of young to middle-aged adults. Median American household net worth in 2004 was found to be $99,500. Among Jewish respondents, it was $443,000. Just to give you a sense of the topography that they're describing in the Triple Package, lots of callers. Shannon in Cookeville, Tennessee. Shannon, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question has to do with if everybody adopts these values, which seem okay and reasonable to me, and I don't actually think they're racist particularly, but my question is how can everybody make it into the top? I mean, by definition, there's a pyramid, and there's a few people at the top, a few people who go to Ivy League schools, a few people who become Supreme Court justices, and so on like that. No matter how hard everybody works, everybody is not going to be extremely successful.
Jed, what do you say to that?
Well, first, my definition of success, here's what it means to me, achieving your goals, whatever they are. And
That's not the definition you give in this book, I must point out.
No, that's not true at all. We focus on material success in the book for two reasons. First, because it's something you can measure. Mm-hmm. And second, mm-hmm. because for a lot of people, it is one of their goals. But throughout the book, we point out that there are other ways to succeed. And the Triple Package actually can help people achieve their goals, whatever they are, whether it's being an artist or a singer, or breaking away from society's expectations completely. But to really try to answer your listener's question, what I would say is our bottom line is everyone from any background can achieve and achieve at a high level. We're not – you know, it's not important to – it doesn't have to be important whether you make it to the top. It's achieving your own goals and achieving at a high level. That's what our book is about.
I have to say that's not really what it feels like it's about. This is about top achievement. This is about exceptionalism and getting there. I mean, Amy, what about our caller saying, you know, what about the rest of society? This isn't...
Tom, it's so interesting. You know that we have a whole chapter on the pathologies, and actually we define this emphasis on material wealth and conventionalism, like needing to have these badges as part
of what is
wrong
with these
cultures. The
gaining of money and position. You have a quoting Oliver Wendell Holmes there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then we say that this is actually one of the downsides of this, an overemphasis possibly on these material forms. But to answer your question, what can – you know, it at the end of the day – our book is about individuals, and this is how we begin, and it's how we end. And the way in, let me just give you an example. I got an amazing email yesterday from somebody who said, look, I'm not in one of those groups. I'm, you know, 10th generation American, but I was raised by a single grandmother, and she instilled every one of these qualities in me. And what I learned is, you know, I had a rough childhood, but I somehow made it on my own. I'm not a tycoon, but I have a job I'm proud of, and it's that the fact that I made it on my own, nobody has anything on me. So when you were talking about a superiority complex, the content doesn't have to be related to a group. I think the only kind, I mean, the best kind of a sense
it is
of
in your title, you know, The Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. Groups. It is the title of your book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we stand by that. We all our case studies are about these groups. But at the end of the day, I think when an individual can make the source of his own hard work and overcoming adversity, you know, and persevering and achieving what their dreams are, make that into their own source of personal superiority, you know, I think that is something maybe worth aspiring to.
Let's go to Paul in Nashville, Tennessee. Paul, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jed and Amy.
Hi.
I am the son of a first-generation Jewish, I would call her a tiger mom, and between her and the rest of my family, I got the triple package. I was always told I was wonderful and very intelligent by most of my family, but my mom got to play the bad cop, and she was always criticizing my behavior, so I learned self-restraint. And also, she made sure that I never felt like I was doing well enough. I would have to say I ended up with something of an inferiority complex, but I also turned out successful.
So what are you saying there, Paul? Are you happy for the triple package you got? Do you agree with Jed and Amy that this is a success formula?
It is successful, but I don't think it's happy. I recently had a lunch with three of the guys I grew up with in the neighborhood. Two of us are pretty successful. You could argue happy. The other two, not so much. And the four of us agreed that the two of us who were more successful definitely had the toughest moms.
Tough mom, and so you got the success, but some questions about whether, well, you've got the unhappiness formula in there, too. I guess that's life. That's life on this planet. I mean, Amy, you've got a whole chapter on pathologies that can come along with the package.
Well, we could not agree more with the caller. We have a whole chapter saying that there's a dark side, there's an underside to all three of these elements, and what the caller is saying, he's putting his finger on the critical point. If you have this insecurity, you feel like what you are or what you've done is never good enough. That's what's driving you. That's what's pushing you on. And that is not a pleasant feeling. And so there can be a trade-off. There isn't always, but there can be a trade-off between success and happiness. And we write about that in the book.
You know, in some ways, I think the book has been so mischaracterized. I mean, the first page of our book says, this offers a new way to look at success. It's hidden dynamics, it's inner spurs, and it's costs. You know, this is not a sugarcoating book about everybody should do this. In a way, I think the books about success are there. Do sugarcoat. They say, just be confident and believe in yourself, you know, and have some grit. Ours is trying to get at what generates drive, what makes some people motivated. And for me, the most interesting feature is what the caller just talked about, this how can you simultaneously feel like you're, you know, that you're such the best person, you're amazing, and that you're not good enough yet. And that double-edged sword, I think, is fascinating, but can be a real motivator.
You know, as I read this, on the one hand, thinking that you've got something special, of course, that's empowering. A little insecurity, of course that's going to drive people. Delayed gratification, impulse control, I mean, sure, that goes all the way back to Calvinism and all the rest. And yet the emphasis on the cultural roots of this and cultural groups, I worry about. You know, as a white American who came up in the middle of the 20th century, and had all of these factors, in my particular case, at work in the background. But I was always told, never put this in terms of you and your cultural group. Always open your mind to the full capacity of others, whatever their cultural group, that this kind of thinking is actually dangerous for this country, a democracy like ours, where holding certain ethnic and cultural groups up, well, we've seen it in plenty of other countries, but here too can be, well, somebody wrote that this is a pollutant to our social system. And I guess as a kid, I was taught, don't go down this road. This is not the way to think about society or yourself, Amy.
Well, you know, I guess people can differ. I mean, I have the exact opposite view. It's one thing to be, you know, supremacist in some way. But we actually, if you notice, we purposely chose these terms in our book. I think it's a very subtle book. You know, we could have called these three elements you know, confidence and willpower, but we purposely chose quite ambivalent terms like a superiority complex and insecurity. I mean, that is not a positive term. And, you know, it's to get people thinking and, you know, people make their own choices. Now, when you say talking about cultures like this, I just have to come back and stress the dynamism. I mean, it's not like the Chinese have this culture that is essentialist and it always stays this way. You know, people come from China and then it's their interaction with their heritage, with America, which is very dynamic. And then suddenly you're an outsider here and the second generation doesn't agree with the first generation. I mean, a repeated pattern is that the second generation doesn't like this idea. You know, the parents are saying, oh, the Persian culture was the most magnificent or the Chinese culture. Their children are, what? Don't talk about that. That's intolerant. You know, it doesn't resonate for me. And these are some of the themes and that we explore in our book without saying this group is better or that group is better. I think it's a very unifying book because we say groups as different as Nigerian Americans or Liberian Americans and Jews and Korean Americans, you know, we have these cultural commonalities that cut across groups and change over time.
Unifying, I don't know. These subtleties in human history, they get lost a lot. But Amy Chua, Jed Rubenfeld, stand by. The new book is The Triple Package. Richard Alba joins us right now from New York, professor of sociology at the Graduate Center at City University of New York, author of Ethnic Identity and Remaking the American Mainstream. Richard Alba, welcome. Thank you for joining us. What do you make of the thesis here, sir?
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Tom. Well, I think I would emphasize to Amy and to Jed that the way their book is read by most readers isn't apparently the way they are now presenting the book. And I join you, Tom, in saying that there's a lot of emphasis here on groups and cultures. Now, to be fair to them, I think that they confront some facts about ethno-racial inequalities in our society that make a lot of Americans uncomfortable. And I think also that they are right in saying that culture plays some role in explaining these inequalities, group success or lack of success. But to my mind, the book blows that role entirely out of proportion, and it ignores a lot of the other extrinsic factors that affect how groups do in American
society.
What
does that mean, extrinsic?
Well, okay, so for me, you know, I'm surprised that law professors largely ignore the way that a law and government, U.S. government policy create advantages for some groups and disadvantages for others. And let me take Cubans as a case in point. The book never mentions the substantial financial assistance that was extended by the U.S. government to the early waves of Cuban arrivals on the basis that they were refugees. So, for example, the members of this group who were also members of the pre-Castro elite, people who came with a lot of professional qualifications, business experience, they had privileged access to Small Business Administration loans. And this helped them then to develop their own businesses and ultimately led to an extensive Cuban sub-economy in Miami. In fact, Cubans received more U.S. aid than any other immigrant group in our history. So, you know, to me, that's an advantage they had that other immigrant groups clearly have.
But you can't say that about Nigerians or Chinese Americans who actively discriminated against Jews too for a long time.
Let me finish. You're right.
Sure.
But let me just say one more thing. There's also the issue of legal status. And this is an issue of huge importance for Latinos and their success in American society. Under current U.S. law, any Cuban who reaches U.S. soil is legal. The question then of unauthorized status, which obviously is so much a part of our political discourse at the moment, and which also haunts so many Latin American immigrants and even creates disadvantages for their U.S.-born children, does not exist for Cubans because of U.S. law.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Tiger Mom Amy Chua and husband Jed Rubenfeld, now writing about what they say makes some ethnic and cultural groups successful in America. Their book is The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits explain the rise and fall of cultural groups in America. They're talking about a sense of superiority, a sense of insecurity, and impulse control. Richard Alba joins us as well, sociologist at the City University of New York, author of Ethnic Identity and More. Richard, I'll come right back to you on that front. Amy and Jed, I want to hear your reply as well. But we've got Anthony calling on your point, Richard, from Boston. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, Professor from Cooney, he's got it right. There are some legal advantages that certain ethnic groups have been extended. So, for example, the great waves of Puerto Ricans that came in the 30s, a lot of them tried to set up their shops, as the Greeks did, selling shish kebabs near Central Park. And Fiorello LaGuardia made it illegal to do that. He said, they're going to work in the factories. And what happened after that, many of them lost their jobs, and a lot of them became part of the poverty cycle. And so there were not many elites that came from Puerto Rico in the 30s. And so I agree, there are extrinsic legal factors that contribute to the success or not success of ethnic groups.
Anthony, I appreciate your call. Jed Rubenfeld, what about it? Extrinsic issues, structural issues here, not fully enough acknowledged in the book, says Richard. And our caller, Anthony, Jed.
I agree with him. I agree with 90% of what Richard Alba said. I agree completely with what the caller just said. In fact, Professor Alba, I'm a great admirer of your work, and we cite you a lot in our book. Here's the thing. It would be comforting to be able to explain all of these phenomena in the way that through these extrinsic factors. But with all due respect, I think Professor Alba is just missing our point. Let's take the Asians in New York City. There's an extraordinary fact that we talk about in our book. Stuyvesant High School is a public high school in New York City, and it is selective. Admissions are based solely on an exam. It's a major feeder to our best universities. In 2013, the incoming class consisted of 9 African-American students, 24 Hispanic-American students, 177 whites, and 640 Asians. And many, many, a great percentage of these Asians are from families that are poor and whose parents are poorly educated. And they are not receiving special handouts from the U.S. government. I think what a lot of people are doing are thinking that we're comparing that group to, let's say, undocumented Hispanic Americans or to other groups who have had histories of discrimination and legal disabilities imposed on them. That's not our book. That's not what we're doing. We're saying that these Asians are outperforming America, white America, all Americans. They're outperforming the Asian poor, are outperforming the white poor, the American poor in general. And what we're saying is, look, we can bury our heads in the sand, or we can look at this and ask, how are they doing it? What's happening? Should we be afraid of this? I don't think so. I think we can look at it. And, you know, when we did look at it, we found that they and other groups, other successful groups all over the country, are doing it in a very similar way. In one way, I just want to say this is something that's the opposite of divisive in our book. We're talking about commonalities of the most disparate groups, all different races, many different religions. We're showing what they have in common and, in fact, what they have in common with traditional American values. I don't think that's divisive. I think it's the opposite.
Richard Alba, first, what do you make of this Stuyvesant incoming class that this isn't divisive? This is open to anybody. Let's go.
Well, okay. Let me take both of those. So I think the problem I have with the book is that it doesn't really treat fairly these other kinds of factors that don't have to do with the inherent qualities of the group and its culture. And I gave two examples. I didn't mean them to be exhaustive. But let me directly go to the issue of Asians in the U.S. And here I think the factor the book doesn't adequately address is what is often called the selectivity of immigration. So selectivity means that immigrants from any country have on average more positive traits than the average citizen of the countries from which they come. They have generally more education, they have better health, they have more ambition and drive. The degree of selectivity is highly variable. It varies depending on the difficulty groups have of gaining entry to the United States. And the reality is that because of the racist history of U.S. immigration law, because of the emphasis in current U.S. immigration law on family reunification, Asians have had a harder time getting into the United States than, say, Latin Americans. 10% of the Mexican nation resides in the United States. For Asians, for Indians, the fraction of immigrants in relation to the population is tiny, tiny, tiny.
But they're not even all the same. Indians may be well-placed in coming. Chinese, lots of the poorest Chinese came to America.
Right. Okay. But they have tremendous drive to get here. It's very difficult.
Poverty is one drive. Hunger is a drive.
Well, I think also you have to take into account that they probably have very different long-term goals than do people who can easily come across the border. So their goals are often more intergenerational. They put a great deal of emphasis on the achievement of their children as a way of validating the sacrifices they've had to undertake in coming here. All I'm saying is that the profiles of groups are different. They're different not simply because of the cultures, but also because of the conditions that the hurdles they have to leap over in order to get to the United States.
This is not divisive. This is unifying. Pick up that theme.
I don't see that. I don't see that. I'm sorry.
Speak to it.
And I want to remind the authors that there's really a long history in the United States of using cultural explanations to try to account for group success. And although they've walked back from saying that they're calling groups superior in the book really does.
We never called groups superior.
Well, we never Jed, back I'm sorry.
I have to say this.
The book.
Excuse me. Many of your listeners will not have read the book, and they have read that statement over and over online in the media. We never say anywhere in the book that any groups are superior. We never say any groups are better. All we're saying is that some groups are doing better right now.
You do talk about the extraordinary success of some groups. It's undeniable.
Yes, and, yes that's exactly what we're talking
about. And therefore, doing better.
And you do provide a cultural explanation for that extraordinary success. Let me put it to you this way. In the past, these kinds of explanations all too easily have veered off into kind of ethnic self-congratulation on the part of members of groups that are doing well and denigration. I admit it's implicit here because you don't really talk about the groups that are in the middle, but denigration of the groups that are not at the top. Now, you acknowledge here that there are a lot of groups that have the average incomes of some of the groups that you're picking as very successful. I want to point out to you, though, that you're picking very small groups. I mean, Jews are probably the largest of the groups, and they're about 2% of the population. You mentioned Lebanese and Iranians and, Greeks. But the reality is that many of these groups have incomes that are just a bit above average. There's a lot of other people that are in the mix here, but they don't see themselves reflected in this book. And I think that's a problem, frankly. And it's why there's such pushback against the book and a perception that, as Tom is putting it to me or asking me to address, it isn't all that unifying, your thesis.
Amy, what about the danger? You've written about it abroad. What about in this country in a time of great inequality? You're writing about hedge fund billionaires of this or that cultural or ethnic group. What about the danger of ethnic self-congratulations and pushback against that? I mean,
I think that people see a lot what's out on the internet. And I have to stress something that Dr. Alba said. He said that the way people are reading the book, what I find striking is that no one could have read the book except for people like Professor Alba because it's not out yet. So I think
there are plenty of review copies out there. I mean, a lot of people have read it who have written in depth about it.
But you'll see a lot of people say, I haven't read the book, but this is what, But I also have received tons of emails. I talked to tons of people, African Americans, Puerto Rican Americans, everybody of all ethnicities who have actually read the book. And so many people say this resonates for me. I had an Ecuadorian immigrant mother, and she instilled the sense of exceptionality in me. I was a brown-skinned outsider, and I know exactly how it feels, that this feeling of I need to work 20 times as hard because the system is against me. So I know that Professor Alba has harsh words for us, but I don't actually disagree with much of what he says because I think, for example, that America tends to attract – he used the word profile – immigrants – of all backgrounds, whether from Mexico or, you know, Liberia, with these triple package qualities. Because what kind of person gets up and crosses an ocean or, you know, it takes some drive, it takes some grit, and maybe a feeling that you need to prove something. And there are some studies out there that suggest that, you know, this. So I don't disagree with the selection factor at all. But I will say that people who read the book, you know, this is a very kind of a weird characterization. We say outright that when you're looking at the most disadvantaged groups in our country, the poorest groups, we totally agree with Dr. Alba. Why are some groups so disadvantaged? It has to do with history. Histories of discrimination, legal exclusion, lack of opportunity, schools that fail our minorities.
If some cultures advantage their members, isn't it implicit, isn't that other cultures disadvantage their members?
At any given point in time, some cultures do clearly establish more discipline. For example, it's just a fact. It's not a stereotype. Mormon kids, they statistically do not drink nearly as much. They don't have premarital sex. And they go when other kids are going on 18 drinking binges, they are on the mission. And they are, you know, in suits and ties 6 days a week, working from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. knocking on doors, and that instills a sense of discipline. Now, we're not saying that the Mormons are superior, but it's interesting that a culture that inculcates that sense of kind of discipline, when, you know, really quite striking, you know, falls in line with some of these other groups. And immigrants in general impose higher expectation and stricter rules on their kids. In general, I mean, this is not having to do with Chinese or, you know, any immigrants tend to.
Amy, let me give me a couple more calls here. Tina, Rumford, Rhode Island. Tina, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm calling as a woman who has three young children, who is I'm half Chinese, and I was raised with my mother and my Jewish, Polish, Russian father from Brooklyn.
Okay.
And I went to Bronx Science, which is the rival school of Stuyvesant. Mm-hmm. I had a very atypical family in that my father ended up being, like, you know, middle-class Jew who ended up being downwardly mobile, and my family was basically working poor.
Mm-hmm.
But so a lot of what's being said really resonates with me in terms of this idea of seeing no obstacles and working really hard. But I also think that, you know, it's unfortunate. I haven't read the book, and it's unfortunate to hear some of the good points being deflected or discussed in the context of the kind of grouping and the criticism about grouping cultures, because to me it boils down to qualities that kind of cut across class and culture, which is like sort of grit versus a sense of entitlement. And I'm an educator, and so I've been reading a lot lately about what makes children successful, whatever success means, and that really just means realizing your potential. And, you know, people are starting to think that grit, which is, you know, maybe an amorphous term, but grit is a quality. Resilience and grit and coming back to the table after making mistakes is what ensures success. And in my own family, I see that my father, who grew up in a very privileged background, had a sense of entitlement. In the 1950s, it was a golden age. You know, he went to university. And my mother, who, you know, whose parents were restaurant workers, who immigrated from China, had no sense of entitlement. And
Tina, our time grows short, but I get the distinction you're making. I'm all for the grit. It's the cultural grouping that I think has drawn a lot of this criticism. Let me get one more. Anthony and Phil. Thank you, Tina. Anthony, Philadelphia, you're on the air, Anthony. Our time is short, sir.
Hi, Tom. I have to admit that I haven't read the book. I read a review of it over the weekend. And so with that in mind, I think that no matter what your intentions, that when you make these kinds of arguments, you end up invoking, you know, a long history of scientists and social scientists making these kinds of arguments and trying to categorize groups as either inferior or superior, going back to 19th century phrenologists, early 20th century eugenicists. Richard Alba is a paisan like me. He knows that, you know, the eugenicists of the early 20th century made these arguments about Italian immigrants, that they were hot-headed, they lacked impulse control, and so forth, that no matter what you do or what you intend, you end up invoking that long history of, well, racism. On the other hand, the other two parts of the triple package, the superiority of the group versus, you know, kind of inferiority of yourself, I mean, what they're recommending is a kind of neuroticism, right, that we should all be neurotic, right? That's not particularly healthy. At the same time, then, too, what they seem to be ignoring is what we all know, right? That, I'm sure that they know, that Richard Alba knows, that your audience knows because they listen to you about, you know, 40 years of incredibly changes, incredible changes, structural changes in the economy that make it more difficult for the Americans in the middle of the bottom to rise up, that we have, you know, some of the worst, right, numbers in terms of class mobility in the developed world.
Anthony, I've got to step in right there. Amy Chua, I'm going to give you the last word here. You've been good sports. You've taken the brickbats, new racism, and all the rest. You hear, okay. You know the criticism. You've got the floor. You've got a minute left. What do you say to this country?
Well, I would just want to say I agree with the previous speaker, you know, that it comes down. Our book really
you're
is about—
attempting racism here.
No, they're about the traits, the underlying qualities. And the groups change over time, right? But it's the underlying qualities that generate this kind of drive. And I think, you know, I just want to end, I think at the level, at the end of the day, our book is about individuals. And I got an email a couple days ago from a guy.
It says cultural groups right in the title. You always come back there. But it says, doesn't say individuals. It says cultural groups.
Well, but if you read it to the end, it's mm-hmm. always operates through individuals. A guy wrote me, he said, I have a disability. I'm an amputee. And it's that disability, this desire not to be pitied, that gives me the drive and the feeling that I need to prove myself and work 50 times harder. And it's the sense of superiority through overcoming this adversity. That's really, I think that's a unifying force. But hopefully people will read the book and judge for themselves.
Amy Chua, you always mix it up. Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld are authors of the new book, The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. Amy, Jed, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
And Richard Alba at City University of New York, author of Ethnic Identity and Remaking the American Mainstream. Richard Alba, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, I'm really glad to have been here. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.